Hello and welcome back to Catching Up on Capitol Hill, a series in which we discuss the latest in tax legislation and in tax policy. I'm your host, John Gimigliano. When we last spoke, we covered the Trump tax plan. And since then, former President Trump gave a significant speech on tax policy. But here's the good news. He mostly reiterated what we discussed on our last episode. So that episode still stands, and if you haven't listened to it, it is there for you now. But today, we look across the political divide to the tax plan of former President Trump's opponent, Democratic nominee, Vice President Kamala Harris. Now, warning, this is an exceptionally long episode, maybe the longest episode we have ever done. Why? Because Vice President Harris has introduced a number of her own tax proposals, mostly providing tax relief to certain individuals and businesses. But also because, of course, Vice President Harris is part of the Biden administration and has acknowledged that she endorses all or most of the Biden Treasury tax plan, the so-called Green Book. So that's a lot to cover. And to help us sort through this mountain of ideas is my colleague, Dan Winnick. Dan has been with us on previous episodes before, but if you don't recall, Dan was counsel to the Ways and Means Committee as a central player in the development, the drafting, and the negotiation of the Build Back Better legislation of 2021. And prior to that, Dan was in the office of the International Tax Council and Treasury's Office of Tax Policy. So Dan knows a thing or two about both major tax legislation as well as Green Book proposals. Welcome, Dan. Let's dive in. Okay, Dan, my first question to you, and this is before we get to the Harris plan itself, is actually talking about a different plan. Really, the Republican tax plan of 2017, that's, of course, the elephant in the room, the TCJA tax cuts that are expiring in 2025. Kamala Harris was a senator back in 2017. I'm pretty sure she voted against the TCJA, but that's not necessarily going to be her position if she's president and the TCJA comes up for expiration in 2025. So just want to outline for us where we think a Harris administration would be on extending the TCJA tax cuts.
The Harris administration, if it becomes elected next year, is going to face the expiration of many of the individual tax cuts at the end of 2025. The Harris tax plan pledges to extend the TCJA tax cuts for people making $400,000 or less, and that includes both the individual tax brackets as well as some other tax preferences, including the small business deduction under Section 199A for individuals making $400,000 a year or less, is a significant portion of the cost of the TCJA. So it will run into the trillions of dollars by itself, and that's just for maintaining current law.
Wow. So it's going to be pricey either way. Now, let's just to dig into that a little bit more. I think it's obvious what you're saying is we're not talking about an extension of some of those business provisions like the current law guilty rate. We're not talking about extending the current law FIDI rate. We're not talking about extending current law BEAT. All those business provisions, the Harris position is, sorry, those are just going to have to happen. That's correct, right?
Yes. In fact, I think that the Harris position would potentially include some of the items included in the Biden administration's Green Book, which would increase taxes on guilty and increase the corporate rate. Similarly, I expect that the Harris campaign will continue with proposals having to do with business taxes, such as increasing the stock buyback excise tax. So this is just about the individual tax provisions that were in the TCJA, the taxes imposed directly on individuals.
Well, good. I'm glad you brought up Green Book. We're going to come back to that in a second, because I think there's a lot of interesting things to dig into there. So as we start off on the TCJA itself, the business provisions, the Harris position is let those expire, maybe do additional things to them. On the individual side, those making $400,000 or less, we would do an extension. Now, here's the really hard question, Dan, but maybe you got a really good answer for me. What does it mean to make $400,000 or less? How do we define that exactly?
That's a very good question. I think it depends on the exact provision. The biggest change to individual taxation that would happen in 2025 is the simple increase in tax rates. So there, I expect that the $400,000 pledge would apply to taxable income, that we'd be looking at the taxable income brackets and trying to ensure that there's no increase in the tax rates when you're looking at less than $400,000 in taxable income. For other provisions, we might be looking at limitations based on adjusted gross income or some other measure. So there's always been a little bit of uncertainty about exactly what we're measuring when we say $400,000 or less. Especially questions come up when we talk about taxpayers with different filing statuses and how the law might apply, for example, to married filing jointly couples versus single individuals. So that's another point to look at when you're looking at how this commitment translates into legislative proposals down the road.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, this $400,000 pledge is not new. This was the Biden original pledge that Harris has adopted. And you were there during the drafting of Build Back Better. Were you also trying to apply the $400,000 pledge as you thought about some of the proposals during Build Back Better?
Yes. So the $400,000 pledge was influential in the development of Build Back Better and comes up in a number of provisions. And in each provision, we had to consider how to best apply that policy. So it was really a provision by provision process rather than some overarching rule that applied consistently across every provision. Every provision was different, and the possibility, even when remote, of applying to people making less than $400,000 a year was always something that we kept in mind.
So if I were to think about this, since we don't know the answer to it, but at the one extreme, potentially in terms of filing status, for example, married filing jointly, it's possible, I think at the low end, that that married filing jointly return would have itself, it would be defined as the joint in that case. I guess at the other extreme is you might say, well, gee, why can't it be $800,000 for married filing jointly? Are those the two extremes that we're talking about and the reality might be somewhere in between?
Well, that's a great example. The current tax brackets for married filing jointly tend to double the cutoffs for single individuals at the lower rates. But when you get toward the higher end, the difference between married filing jointly and the cutoff for single individuals is much smaller. And I think that that is instructive in thinking about how the pledge might apply in the context of married filing jointly in couples. There's no guidance from the campaign that suggests that married filing jointly couples are subject to a higher pledge amount.
Yeah, it feels like we're overthinking this. As you say, this is a campaign pledge at the moment, and maybe we're thinking about it too hard. Although I've got to believe someone somewhere has done a lot of hard thinking about this or just not yet prepared to talk about exactly how 400,000 would be defined. But eventually, somebody's going to have to put pen to paper and work this out. And it's going to be a complex question. Okay. You mentioned the Green Book proposals. I know what the Green Book proposals are. I think most people do, but maybe not everybody. We get a lot of listeners here are not necessarily tax people. So remind us, what exactly is the Green Book? You worked in the Office of Tax Policy. Tell us what the Green Book is, how it gets developed. Then we can talk about what that might mean in this context.
So each year, the presidential administration puts out its budgetary, so its fiscal policy proposals for the coming fiscal year. And it's the president's opening bid. It's really a political document. It doesn't bind Congress, but it's a source of legislative proposals that Congress often looks to when it's developing law. And so individual provisions in the Green Book can be influential in developing what the law is. And there's often a desire to both have affirmative proposals in the Green Book, so spending proposals or policy proposals, and then to have pay-fors in the Green Book to be fiscally responsible. And the Harris administration's starting point has adopted many of the revenue raisers that are in the Green Book, so the Biden administration's most recent proposal for the budget. Those proposals include a number of additional taxes on corporations. They also include some tax changes for high income and high net worth individuals.
Yeah, it sort of makes sense that she would adopt them. And obviously, she was part of that administration. If she thought that they were bad ideas, you would expect her to have said so and tried to influence it when she was part of that administration. So by virtue of being in the administration and adopting the majority of these, it kind of makes sense. I don't think it came as a shock to everybody when the campaign was confirming with individuals who were asking that, yes, generally, unless we tell you otherwise, Vice President Harris supports the proposals of the Green Book. So let's just talk about a couple of these. The one that gets the most press in the corporate world is her proposal to raise the corporate rate to 28%. That was Biden's proposal as well. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
This is an interesting one because it's one thing to just say the corporate rate itself, but this has ripple effects through a lot of other things too, like just in terms of some of the Pillar 2 changes and proposals. You just want to talk a little bit about how if the corporate rate was 28%, some of the sort of add-on effects that ripple through some of the other proposals?
The corporate rate percent would have a number of implications. Just to take one implication of that, it would impact the rate applicable to foreign income under GILTI under current law. So you'd be looking, with no other changes, at a GILTI rate of around 17.5%. That connection between the GILTI rate and the corporate rate is one potential knock-on effect. Now, the Harris campaign proposal is to tweak that GILTI rate slightly so that we'd be looking at a 21% GILTI rate, but compared to a 28% rate on U.S. income, it's pretty much in line with where current law would be once the TCJA changes go into effect at the end of 2025. The 28% corporate rate also has implications for the United States participation in Pillar 2. One question that House Republicans have raised is, what will happen when foreign countries impose tax on U.S. activities under the under-tax profits rule or under their own income inclusion rules? Well, that rate is at 15%. If the U.S. corporate rate is 28%, even if there are base differences, it's much less likely that Pillar 2 taxes in foreign countries will be applying to U.S. income. So the corporate rate really ripples through a number of the international provisions. Another important point about the corporate rate is how it interacts with the decision of whether to conduct business in a pass-through versus conducting business directly. If the corporate rate increases, that makes pass-through businesses more attractive and raises the question of how Congress and the administration plan to deal with the small business deduction under Section 199A.
Yeah. It's one of those things where you say, hey, good news. We think we've solved the risk of you being subject to UTPR, to which many corporations would say, that's great. They say, but wait till I tell you how. And then they might not be quite so thrilled. But it is fair to say that it would change the exposure to many U.S. multinationals to some of those Pillar 2 taxes. Another one, am I thinking about this right? Many fewer would be subject to CAMTI in a 28% corporate rate world.
That's right. If you raise the regular tax rate, the alternative minimum tax is less likely to apply. In addition, the corporate alternative minimum tax generates a credit, and that's usable when your regular tax is higher than your corporate alternative minimum tax. So current corporate alternative minimum tax taxpayers might find that they use up that tax asset faster if the corporate rate increases.
Yep. Okay. Now, you mentioned a little bit on GILTI already, but you talked about raising the GILTI rate to 21%. There are other changes, right, that the Green Book would do to GILTI. Do you want to spend a minute on those?
In addition to increasing the rate applicable to foreign income under GILTI, the Green Book also proposes to make a number of changes to the way GILTI operates. They would adopt proposals similar to what we saw in the Build Back Better Act proposal that the House passed and the Senate did not adopt ultimately in 2022, which would move GILTI to a country-by-country system. They also would adopt changes to the exclusion for QBI that would generally expand the scope of income that's subject to GILTI. So that has the effect of increasing the amount of GILTI income and increasing the rate applicable to GILTI income. They also would likely adopt proposals that would increase the availability of foreign taxes, because once you move to a country by country system, it's more likely the timing differences between the U.S. and foreign base are going to result in double taxation. And so you need a carry forward system, whereas current GILTI is a year by year system.
An interesting question to me, and maybe to others, is these GILTI proposals that we've had for a couple of years, many of which are designed to get the U.S. into a sort of a Pillar 2 compliant position, many of them predate the emergence of QDMTTs around the world, these qualified domestic minimum top-up taxes. Do you think it's fair to say that these GILTI proposals need a fresh set of eyes because of what the rest of the world has done in QDMTT, or do you think they still make sense?
Well, there are a couple of issues just from the passage of time since these proposals were first aired. One is that the revenue estimates are going to change because they'll have to take into account the qualified domestic minimum top-up taxes that foreign countries impose. Those will generally produce creditable taxes, and those creditable taxes will reduce the revenue from GILTI. Another question is how this will interact with the under-tax profits rules and income inclusion rules that foreign countries impose under Pillar 2. It is one thing for the guilty regime to have been deemed compliant 2 years ago before those rules were coming into law. Now that the Pillar 2 process is a little bit further along, the U.S. negotiators with our counterparts at the OECD will have to discuss how any particular legislative changes interact with the implementation of Pillar 2 around the world.
Guilty is such a complex area. No matter who wins in November, the question of guilty as it relates to how it interacts with what the rest of the world is doing, Pillar 2 is going to be a conversation I'm sure we're having next year. Okay, let's talk about the flip side of guilty, FIDI. The administration's proposal is to repeal FIDI and replace it with some other yet to be described incentive. Is that right, number one? And number two, when you were working on Build Back Better, where did you get to on the FIDI question, just to compare where the administration was and at that time congressional Democrats were?
The administration currently supports repealing FIDI and replacing it with similarly sized incentives that have not been fully described. Congressional Democrats have been generally supportive of the lower rate on foreign-derived intangible income because FDII is seen as an incentive for domestic manufacturing and high-value, high-earning jobs, and often impacts companies that have industrial operations in member districts. And so in Build Back Better, we were looking to actually equalize the rates between guilty and FIDI so that earning FDII in the United States was not taxed at a higher rate than earning guilty outside of the United States. And so from that perspective, FDII had significant support in Congress. In the absence of a compelling proposal that would earn industry and member support to replace FDII, that might be a provision that members are hesitant to repeal.
Obviously, the TCJA was and remains controversial, many parts of it, but there's evidence to show that the FIDI program, no matter what you think about the rest of the bill, has been successful in what it intended to do. And the idea that we're going to repeal it and replace it, as the Green Book sort of describes, with something else that costs exactly the same thing that FIDI costs and basically does the same thing that FIDI costs. I sometimes wonder if what we're really saying here is we're telling the rest of the world, where other countries have argued that FIDI may be an illegal export subsidy or something, like, don't worry, we're going to take care of the FIDI problem. We haven't quite understood how, but we're going to try and make FIDI less controversial by coming up with something new without really knowing what that's going to be yet.
The international relations issues that FDII raise, the view of certain other countries and certain institutions at the OECD that it constitutes a harmful tax practice, is a concern, but it's part of a larger conversation about taxes and going beyond taxes to trade and other fiscal policy. Members would be hesitant to view FDII in isolation and repeal it merely because it's been called into question by international organizations or other countries.
FIDI is going to be one of the really interesting things to watch next year, because based on what you said, and I agree with you, the support for FIDI in Congress, put aside repeal, question whether or not we allow the natural expiration of the current lower rate or the mechanism of FIDI so that the rate on FIDI income is higher. I'm not even sure that will happen, but that's going to be obviously an interesting point to watch Congress negotiate next year. Okay, let me ask you about another one. I get this question a lot. So the administration proposes repealing BEAT, the Base Erosion Anti-Abuse Tax, and replacing it with the UTPR. I get the question all the time, like, really? Would they really repeal the BEAT? So what do you think about this proposal?
So the BEAT raises some challenging issues in a context where the United States tries to adopt Pillar 2, or a tax that's close enough to Pillar 2 that the United States will be treated as participating, because the BEAT applies in its current form to payments outside the United States, even when they're subject to very high rates of tax, and even when they're received by jurisdictions where we have an income tax treaty, because we recognize that residents of that jurisdiction are paying significant tax. And so the adoption of a UTPR is both an effort to raise revenue and also, again, a signal from an international relations perspective that the United States would come into line with what's been negotiated globally at the OECD. ultimately, to the extent that a UTPR is trying to tax low taxed income and QDMTTs or IIRs are adopted around the world, it's possible that a UTPR would not end up being a significant revenue raiser because there just isn't that much income left to tax. If that's the case, perhaps a modification of the BEAT, such as what was done in the Build Back Better proposal, would be close enough to achieve the policy goals around Pillar 2. Ultimately, I don't think UTPR will drive the international tax discussion. And to the extent UTPRs are relevant next year, it's going to be much more the risk of a foreign UTPR being imposed on activities in the United States.
Interesting. So this is a pretty dramatic change, as would repealing FITI. For many companies that are really burdened by the BEAT or constantly monitoring the BEAT, some of them look at this like maybe that's not the worst trade in the world, but others might not exactly love this depending on your given facts. So another interesting one to watch. Okay, let's go to one that I think is pretty straightforward. I think people will understand. We've got this stock buyback provision that was enacted in the Inflation Reduction Act, currently a 1% excise tax. The administration is proposing quadrupling it up to 4%. You were there with the enactment of the original stock buyback. What do you think about the proposal to take it from 1% to 4%?
Well, the stock buyback excise tax for a large revenue raiser was relatively popular and uncontroversial on the Hill. And so I think it's an attractive dial to turn when members are looking for revenue. I think it will be important to determine what the score is at different levels. It's a tax where you would not expect a linear increase in revenues with the increase in rate. We'd expect the revenues to decline with each incremental increase because companies can change their behavior and avoid buying back stock and use their money in other ways. I think that a small increase in the stock buyback excise tax rate is possible, but I think 4% is unrealistic.
Taxpayer behavioral effects minimize the amount of revenue you score. In other words, 4% does not raise four times what 1% raises because at some point people stop buying back stock.
Yes. A simple example is that companies would then maybe choose to pay dividends at the current rates, which is more flexible. They might also change their compensation to increase the stock issued under executive compensation plans to make up for stock buybacks. There are plenty of other dials that companies have when the stock buyback excise tax becomes less of a nuisance and more of a material item that they can look to.
Yeah, as a matter of tax policy, it's sort of a fascinating question. What's the goal of the proposal? Is it to raise revenue or is it to stop something from happening? Right? Because after the TCJA sort of Democratic rallying cry was, okay, these companies are getting all these windfalls and all they're doing is buying back stock. They're not paying their employees more. They're not hiring jobs. They're not investing. They're just buying back stock. If you really just hate stock buybacks and you want them to end, then 4% is great. Right. It may not raise any money, but if that's your policy goal, that's great. But I'm not sure that's the policy goal when you're up against trillions of dollars of tax cuts expiring. You're trying to raise revenue. It's kind of worth doing it mostly for the money. Is that the way you think they might be thinking about it? If you can't raise money out of it, what's the point?
Yes, I think members would prefer a revenue maximizing rate to a rate that would effectively prohibit stock buybacks.
I'm with you. I totally agree. Okay. Look, we've been talking about some of these business proposals. Let's just hit two more on the Green Book that apply to individuals. So we've got the Harris proposal. It's kind of a two-pronged piece on the so-called billionaires tax. And I use the term so-called. You could tell us why I'm saying so-called. And then also a tax on capital gains, how you would tax capital gains, slightly different. So go ahead and talk about the billionaires tax first.
So the billionaires tax, which actually would apply to individuals with over $100 million in wealth, would generally tax unrealized capital gains using a kind of minimum tax approach. So having seen the popularity of the corporate alternative minimum tax and ability to pass that through Congress, they've expanded the notion of minimum taxes back to individuals and said, well, we think that there's all this income that's effectively available but unrealized for tax purposes, and we want to tax that. So looking at unrealized capital gains plus regular taxable income and applying a lower rate to that. If that amount exceeds your regular taxable income, you would pay a top-up tax. And this would only apply to individuals making with more than $100 million in wealth.
Yeah, and we've heard a lot about this on the campaign trail. You know, even Donald Trump is talking about this proposal, you know, taxing unrealized capital gains. I kind of wonder how much that resonates with the average person, if they know exactly what that means. I don't use the word radical. I don't mean radical in the political sense, but it is a sort of a radical departure from the taxation of individuals. Yeah, we have other parts of the tax code where we tax unrealized gains, but as it applies to individuals, this would kind of be pretty novel. Do you agree, or do you think it's not that radical of an idea?
Well, I think that it would raise a number of questions. There is even a question of whether or not it would be constitutional as an income tax, or it would be treated as an unconstitutional direct tax. And I think that there are a lot of members of Congress, even on the Democratic side, that might have questions about this policy, especially as it applies to business owners in their district or certain individuals who, although they may have high wealth, are also pillars of the community. And so it's a proposal that's been in the last few green books, but probably the most controversial proposal that has come out of the Biden-Harris administration.
I agree with you. And that's why it's sort of interesting that if you're going to break with the green book anywhere, this is a bold move to pick this one up out of the green book. And it's not like Vice President Harris hasn't broken with other proposals in the Green Book, and I'm going to ask you about one. So the taxation of realized capital gains, there's a difference here between where Harris is and Biden, right?
There is a bit of a difference. The Harris proposal is to increase the rate on realized capital gains to 28% from the current rate of 20%. The Biden administration proposal would tax capital gains of high income individuals at the same rate as ordinary income. So there is a small difference in the rate there, if not the core policy.
Right. So the idea is the same, but maybe slightly more pragmatic. Because remember, all of these things have to pass Congress. So it may be more realistic in what you can actually get through even a democratically controlled Congress. Last one from the Green Book. The idea that we would eliminate the step up of basis at death. So today's law, when you pass away, your unrealized gains, your basis in those assets is stepped up to the fair market value so that there is, in effect, no gain on those assets. The proposal here is to repeal that. So how would that work? You would have a tax liability on the difference between basis and fair market value at death under this proposal. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Under this proposal, subject to minimum limitations to prevent many people with relatively small net worth at death from being subject to this tax, it would tax built-in gains at the time of death and repeal the current law step up in basis. It would also apply that rule to assets held in trust. And it would apply that rule in such a way that assets in kind of dynasty trusts would be taxed within this revenue window. So it would tax at the end of the 10-year scoring window, and that increases significantly the revenue from this proposal. There are other proposals to address the step up in basis at death that would treat death more like a gift, where the person inheriting the assets succeeds to the basis of the decedent. The issue with those proposals from a revenue perspective is that unless the person who inherits the property disposes of it within the 10-year revenue window, you're not seeing that revenue from a scoring perspective. And so from a Green Book perspective, proposing realization at death brings in a lot more revenue. These are proposals that have been considered in Congress, but again, have targeted opposition, especially in certain rural areas. So this is another example of a proposal that's been around, but it's been difficult for Congress to adopt.
Yeah, I mean, this one will be controversial, certainly with Republicans, absolutely, but maybe even with Democrats. You think about the small business owner. I think you're alluding to farms when you talk about rural areas. You know, you've got the small business owner as well who passes away, the ability to pass that business on to their children without having to liquidate assets to pay the tax. I mean, these are the kind of scenarios that Congress always talks about, which makes it politically challenging. But it's been around for quite some time, as you said, Dan, and you're right. That interim proposal, you know, the carryover basis proposal, seems like maybe a fair compromise, wouldn't it? But as you say, it probably doesn't raise anything. So that undermines a lot of its appeal if it doesn't really raise that much revenue. Okay, that's the Green Book. There are many more. That is not an exhaustive list, but those are sort of the tent poles of the Green Book tax proposals. Let's talk about a few of Harris's own proposals now that she has talked about quite a bit on the campaign trail. The first of these proposals is one that is familiar to you if you listened to last week's episode on the Trump tax plan, and that is to eliminate taxes on tips. Where do we think this idea came from?
Conversations out on the campaign trail, perhaps even in swing states such as Nevada. And there have been proposals in Congress to reduce taxation on tip income. How exactly those operate? Are we talking about a proposal that would deduct from income but still subject those tips to Social Security and Medicare? Or are we talking about a proposal that would strip those out of the Social Security and Medicare tax base as well? It's very important. If you take the latter approach, potentially you're reducing those tipped workers' Social Security benefits down the line. So it's something that Congress would have to consider closely if it ends up taking up that proposal by both campaigns.
That's a really good point. And we talked last week on the Trump episode about guardrails, you know, all the various guardrails that could be put in place here. So I don't know, you know, maybe I'm cynical, but I always ask myself, like, what's the least amount Congress can do and still declare that they made good on the promise? And that could be all sorts of limitations on what the excludable amount is, as you say. And so in the end, you're like, oh, okay, it's better than nothing, but it wasn't what everybody thought it might be to begin with. So that was one that the candidates share. Here's a couple that are unique to Harris. This new deduction for startup businesses. Go ahead and talk about that, because that's a novel idea.
This would be a large expansion of the deduction for expenses that startups can take. The Harris campaign has proposed a $50,000 deduction for startup expenses and would allow small business owners to take that deduction over time. Often businesses in their early years run losses, they don't earn income. And so for a deduction to actually be valuable, it would need to be available in a later year when a taxpayer actually has income. This is a part of the tax spending proposals, which has really been what Vice President Harris has leaned into on the campaign trail when it comes to tax policy.
Yeah, when I first heard this one, I was like, this is smart. Because it sounds good, sounds really good, but the practical reality is it's not going to be as good in the real world as it sounds, because as you say, many startups might not be able to use this for quite some time, and that would help minimize the revenue cost of this. So one of those things you could propose, that it sounds like every new business gets $50,000, when in effect, what we're really getting is a carry forward into some point in the future, and everybody, of course, hopes to use it. Many of them may never get used, or they may be used even outside the 10-year budget window. Is that right?
That's right. And how the limitations of such a proposal operate when you actually get down to legislative drafting will impact how it might be available for a particular taxpayer. For example, if you have a married filing jointly couple with one member of the couple working on a startup and the other with a regular wage job, would you be able to offset wage income with the startup deduction, or is it going to be siloed in some fashion? These are questions that really will affect the revenue score. And then from a policy perspective, to the extent that you're making cash available for a startup, not currently when the startup is facing the expenses, but at some indeterminate time in the future, it's very hard to monetize that tax asset if you're a small business. It's not as if a bank is going to give you a loan because in the future you have a tax deduction. They're not going to see that asset as collateral. And so it's a powerful campaign point for showing support for startups and very small businesses, but its practical impact on a real small business startup raises a lot of questions.
Yeah, and if this was a very large company, publicly traded, you know, you might say, well, at least we got a deferred tax asset on that thing. That's not worth nothing. But, you know, these are tiny companies, right? There's no such thing as a deferred tax asset really in their world, because there's no real deferred accounting and on published financial statements and that sort of thing. So it's of questionable value. It's not of zero value, right? And it will depend largely on some businesses might make money right away. Some might never. So that's an interesting one. As you say, the drafting on that will be challenging. All right, let me ask you about another one, because we apparently love small businesses. Everybody loves small businesses. We've got this new new standard deduction for small businesses. I think we all know how a standard deduction works in our own lives on individual returns. What would it mean in the small business context?
It raises a lot of questions. Is this really an effort at administrative simplicity? Instead of tracking income and expenses, would it allow businesses to simplify their accounting by having a standard deduction available? Or is this a way of increasing expenses in early years that a business is in operation or effectively exempting from tax a portion of interest for income for very small businesses? So that's another proposal where there's an effort to show support for micro businesses where it might just really be one or two people, but we don't know how it's actually would play out in practice.
How it plays out in practice is an important question because, I don't know, when I think about it compared to the individual standard deduction, look, there's only one of me, and I can't make another one of me. But a business, like, what is a business? Are we going to see a proliferation of small businesses as every small idea you come up with, you're going to have as a separate business so it qualifies for its own standard deduction? Look, I get it. Yeah, I know what you're already thinking. Yeah, you're going to have related party rules. Fine, we can do that. But it just complicates matters as to what the behavioral response would be to this one is a curious one to me. Okay, here's one that is very new. We just got this in a speech this week. I'm not sure exactly what it is, so maybe you can explain to me. What is the America Forward Tax Credit?
Well, that is another tax credit that Vice President Harris has announced recently, and we still don't have details about it, but the proposal would provide a tax credit for companies that expand union jobs and manufacturing communities. So again, an effort to show support for manufacturing jobs and especially the Midwest and other manufacturing regions in the country. Beyond the proposed revenue, and the campaign was looking at a very large spend for this credit, we don't know exactly how it would be targeted.
Right now, based on the little bit of information we have, it's a little bit of an all things for all people kind of credit. Part of me wonders if this is an attempt to respond to Trump's proposal on a 15% rate on domestic manufacturing. Is this Harris's retort to that, saying, well, I've got a plan too? It's slightly different, but this is what it is. You think it's possible that it's at least a rhetorical response?
There's a strong connection between what those two proposals are intended to show support for. They're both intended to show support for lower taxes on domestic manufacturing. And so I think that's right.
Yeah, at least partly that's it. Now, I'm sure there's policy around it as well, and I'd love to see the more details, and hopefully we'll get that at some point. Okay, last topic. We mostly talked about business stuff. We can't ignore the proposals that Harris has for individuals, because maybe if you were to ask the campaign, these are the most important parts of her proposal. So tell us a little bit about what she has proposed on things like the child tax credit, the earned income tax credit. These are important proposals.
These are very central proposals to the campaign and were the top tax priorities that Vice President Harris had when she was in the Senate. She's committed to restoring the American Rescue Plan expanded child tax credit and the additional child tax credit for the first year of a child's life, also expanding the earned income tax credit for non-parents, so showing support through the tax system for all low-earning households through the EITC, and making the ACA tax credits permanent. That's going to be another big motivator for Democrats to have a tax bill next year. And finally, the emphasis of the campaign on housing and housing tax credits, both for home builders and for homeowners, is very important. Vice President Harris has been very concerned with housing costs, especially coming from California, and that concern about housing pervades the campaign. All of those individual proposals have very large price tags. And so it again raises the question of how to balance the cost of the expiring tax provisions, which is trillions of dollars, and then these further proposals, which would also add up very quickly, when many of the revenue proposals that we've discussed are ones that the current administration has shown support for, but has not been able to enact into law.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned those housing proposals because, yeah, right, those are really important too. And the big point you just made is absolutely the point. It's why we really wanted to talk to you about these proposed revenue raises, because we're talking about just extending the TCJA provisions of trillions. We don't know exactly how much it is when you apply that $400,000 limit, mainly mostly because we don't know what the $400,000 limit is exactly. But that plus these other proposals, we're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars of new tax cuts or extending existing tax cuts got to be paid for somehow. And that's why those other revenue raisers we talked about are ones that you all should be focused on if they're important to you. Okay, well, that's all we have time for today, Dan. Thank you very much.
In closing, let's keep this short. We've said enough. But if you're asking yourself why Kamala Harris would support the Green Book proposals with all of its revenue raisers, well, let's talk about that for a minute, because your curiosity, it's warranted. If you recall, Tom Stout said on our last episode, the Trump episode, that nobody's ever really been elected president by proposing to raise taxes. And I think that's probably true to a certain extent. But here's the thing. There's a certain advantage for Harris to talk about these revenue raising proposals in abstract terms anyway. First of all, Vice President Harris was part of the administration that released the Green Book, so she can't really completely disavow them to begin with. But to go further, you may have seen her in recent days and weeks say that she believes that corporations and the wealthy should pay their fair share. Now look, you and I, as tax policy people, might find that a little wanting in specifics. However you define fair share is almost certainly different from how I define fair share or somebody else defines fair share. But you see, that is a feature, not a bug, in the Harris messaging strategy around taxes. Now, maybe this is all obvious, but maybe we should just say it anyway. This approach on tax messaging has the advantage of allowing the Harris campaign to support a number of tax cuts for individuals and certain businesses while also declaring the overall plan to be fiscally responsible, that they would pay for this tax relief by simply making corporations wealthy pay their fair share. Kind of hard to oppose that, right? If you're against the plan, then what does that mean? You don't want corporations to pay their fair share? That's kind of a political loser. So you see, that's why you hear and see the Trump campaign and its surrogates out there trying to talk about the perils of taxing unrealized capital gains. And no matter what you think of that proposal, whether you're for it or against it, you have to admit, it's kind of hard to get the point across to a non-tax audience. As they say in Washington, if you're explaining, you're losing. Now, look, I'm not saying anybody is winning or losing this tax debate to the extent the candidates are even really having one. I'm just saying that Harris's soft embrace of the Biden-era revenue-raising provisions, it might seem unorthodox at first. But when you think about it, it makes some sense for her and for her campaign. So in closing, I know that you know what unrealized capital gains are, and I know that you know what country-by-country guilty is and FDII repeal and so on. And so I promise you, we're going to talk about all those topics coming in the near future. Until then, thanks again for tuning in to Catching Up on Capitol Hill. We'll be back soon with another episode on the coming tax cliff of 2025.